fingers to my cheek before I pulled again away. "Does she have a name?" she asked the Belgian animal dealer. He shrugged. "Pia," she announced. "Let her be called Pia." And so I was christened. I was used to the company of the herd, but the strange variety and quantity of members in this newly encountered troop was bewildering. There was something unnervingly phlegmatic about the other animals. They followed the orders of their human masters unquestioningly. They settled in their cages without protest. Even the big cats. I had known them as beasts that roamed in packs, prowling and snarling and tearing smaller animals apart with their teeth. Now, a lion asked me drowsily, "Come far." From the confines of my concrete chamber, I felt a pang of longing as I recalled the vast moonlit nights I'd once known. "Welcome to the GDR," sighed the lion. "GDR?" I asked. "German Democratic Republic, comrade," he replied with unhidden sarcasm, raising a fisted paw beside his head in salute. "Anyway, now that you're here, there's no going back." The circus didn't perform or tour over the winter. For whole days at first, Mitzi would come and simply stay near me, feeding me an apple now and then through the bars, watching, quietly. Back then, I would still protest against my prison, rubbing heavily back and forth against the railings with my hide, trying to use my strength to break through. "Shh," Mitzi would whisper gently. "Quiet now." The futility of resistance dawned on me only slowly, but as it did, Mitzi's confidence grew. She would step behind the bars with me now, holding back at first, the two of us eyeing each other across the cage. Then, slowly she came closer, making that tutting cicada sound, until I felt enough at ease to let her touch me. Slowly she would fold the flaps of my ears between her fingers and play her slim arm along the length of my trunk. Before much longer, I didn't retreat when she made to climb up on my back. She was light as a child. Opening the cage door to lead me outside was her mark of growing confidence in me. I began to understand now why the other animals complied with their trainers. Our gentle guardians made the unfamiliar feel safe in this new, strange world. I began to long for Mitzi when she wasn't with me. "You're doing well with Pia," praised Bruno, the ringmaster. "Will she be ready for the season?" "No problem," Mitzi assured. Our winter encampment had been built up alongside the wall. We trained in its shadow. Only the giraffe could look right over. She claimed things looked just the same on the other side as they did here. "But why is it there?" I asked once. "To keep us safe, of course," snapped one of the ponies. Bred and raised in captivity, the ponies were perhaps the most domesticated of us all. It never occurred to them that there might be questions to be asked. Occasionally, when we were training outdoors, Mitzi would climb up onto my back and stand there, staring quietly across to the other side. At those moments, I wondered if she was thinking of the actor, or maybe just imagining what freedoms might be available to those unconfined. "He sent her letters at first," the giraffe had told me. They had come regularly at the beginning, always pre-opened, of course, pre-read, sometimes with whole paragraphs scratched through with a black marker. "For a while she kept writing, even after his letters stopped," the giraffe said with a sigh. "She thought they must be confiscating his replies." With the opening of the new season, I discovered that I loved performing. The lights, the music, the thrum of excitement. Mitzi and I were a double act. She and I had matching outfits, red sequined feather-hemmed waistcoats and diamante-studded headdresses. I dwarfed her when I stood beside her on my hind legs. With months of practice, she taught me how to clamber atop a wobbly globe and hold my balance. She taught me to lay down and play dead. She had shown me how to make the audience squeal by squirting a bright stream of water over the front rows. Each night, she would take her bow from high up on my shoulders. We traveled throughout the country, parading in our convoy of brightly painted caravans and setting up our tent in fields and vacant lots. Over the years, we even toured abroad, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Soviet Russia. We were the pride of the GDR. At every show, if one looked very closely, there were always a handful of audience members whose gaze was not directed on us in the middle of the ring, but silently across at someone sitting in another row. "The informers," a leopard told me with a surreptitious lift of her eyebrows. "You must have known we're always being watched." We lost Pogo and Chico this way. One afternoon, they began to fool about, play-acting an escape attempt to entertain us. Chico, looking shifty, clambered up and over a makeshift wall, tumbling to freedom, while Pogo pretended to be a border guard, clumsy-footed, dim-witted, tripping over his rifle. They were good clowns, Pogo and Chico. They knew how to make people laugh. But the next afternoon, a black Volvo limousine pulled up at the circus gates. They didn't even have the chance to wipe the grease paint from their faces. That's what I can still remember, their terrified clown faces looking back through the windows as the car drove them away. We never did find out which one of us had informed on our own clowns, but the incident seemed to take away a little of our innocence. For a while now, Mitzi had been watching one of the male acrobats. He was a new recruit, young and fit and extraordinarily talented. He'd trained as a gymnast in Russia. Often, he would head off to train alone, away from the caravans to a plot of grass beneath the trees. We would see him in the far distance, turning the most beautiful backflips. Mitzi would pause, forgetting me, straining with her eyes. It was some weeks before she finally stopped him, trapping him in a quiet corner where no one was likely to hear. "I've seen you," she told him. "I've seen you, measuring out the distance. I've seen you, timing yourself. I've seen you gauging how high you can bounce on your trampoline. 13 seconds it would take you to get across the death strip. You'll be over before the border guard has finished stirring his cup of coffee." "You're talking rubbish," the man said. But there was white fear in his eyes. "I know what I've seen," said Mitzi firmly. She grabbed his hand. "Take me with you." "You're insane," said the man, shaking Mitzi away. The very next day, the acrobat was gone. When the wall finally fell, it was so sudden, as unexpected as the day it went up. Bruno, by now, was white-haired. 3 years retired, he hadn't left us. We were all the family he had. In his caravan, he kept a television set. The aerial could pick up Western broadcasts. On that late autumn evening in November 1989, a yell volleyed from his caravan. "They're letting people through!" He had to move the television into the doorway so all could see. In the animal enclosure, we heard the cheers and laughter, and the elation was infectious. The monkeys shot madly around their cage like lead balls in a pinball machine. The ponies bucked and reared. To be able to just walk across to freedom was more than anyone in this city had dared to dream possible. Amidst this impossible reality, the sight of a blonde woman in a glittering leotard leading a bejeweled elephant across the border didn't seem so very outlandish. All around us, people thronged, pressing forwards into the west, scaling the wall that had confined them for as long as my lifetime. The city that we found on the other side was not that much different, just as the giraffe had noted, but it seemed somehow brighter, shinier, with gleaming advertisements. Coming across a phone booth, Mitzi stopped. On the shelf was a city phone book. She opened it and scanned through the pages, her finger running down the line of names until it came to the one she was looking for. She reached for the receiver and then remembered that the Eastern marks in her purse wouldn't work in this Western telephone. "Will you give me the money for a phone call, please?" she pleaded, catching the sleeve of a passing reveller. "Is that an elephant?" he said incredulously. "I just need enough for one phone call," said Mitzi. "An elephant," laughed the man, pressing the coins into her palm. She slipped them in the slot, stumbled as she dialed the number, and had to start again. Ring, ring. She put a hand on my trunk to steady herself. Her face was pale in the fluorescent light of the booth. Ring, ring. Mitzi didn't even breathe. And then a man's voice answered, "Hello?" Mitzi closed her eyes. She leant against the glass wall of the open booth. Here, finally, a voice she hadn't heard for almost 3 decades. "Hello?" it said again. Behind her, fireworks fizzed and banged, voices cheered. The man must have heard them too. But Mitzi, finally on the line to him, found herself unable to say a word. "Who's on the phone?" came a woman's voice in the background. "No one," he said as he hung up. Alone in the ugly light of the booth, she held the buzzing receiver in her hand, shivering in her sequins. Above us, more fireworks exploded in the sky and shimmered their colours across her face. Mitzi looked around her slowly, not quite ready to take in this new reality. She wasn't young anymore, but she was still beautiful to me. I reached down my trunk and wrapped it round her shoulders. She gave a small, shaky smile as I stroked her hair and cheeks. And then, with steady resolve, I turned her towards home. We returned together, an Indian elephant leading a slim, still blonde, East German circus performer, back through the newly opened border, travelling against the flow of people. They parted to let us through.
Ayesha Dhaka was reading This New Strange World by Claire Wigfall. The producer was Elizabeth Allard. No elephants in this evening's prom, as far as I'm aware, but we do have with us one of Berlin's best-known tourist attractions. I'm Andrew McGregor. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, where the Royal Albert Hall is host to the first of 2 proms given by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and its principal conductor, Sir Simon Rattle. And after the intriguing sequence of Ligeti, Wagner and Sibelius in the first half, Rattle's Berliners are taking us to the ballet in Paris, where Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe was in residence at the Châtelet Theatre. And over the course of a year, they brought to life 2 extraordinary creations commissioned from a pair of French composers. Debussy's Je, a mysterious ménage à trois on a tennis court, and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, his spectacular choreographic symphony based on Greek legend and the tale of a goatherd in love with a shepherdess who's abducted by pirates. As Simon Rattle told me after this morning's rehearsal, the theme from the first half still applies.
The second half is another kind of darkness and light. It's sexual shadows and then moving to ecstatic light. But there's also always this interplay of light in the programme, and this is what the orchestra found. Although it's a normal length concert programme, it felt as though we'd played a 4-hour opera because all the music is so concentrated. From the Sibelius on, there's almost no music where you touch the ground. everything is suggested and then moved away from. So it's been really an adventure for us, and one of the most demanding programs we've ever played.
And both ballet scores offer wonderful opportunities to hear the Berlin Philharmonic at its very best, and Debussy's Je has a few links of its own with the sound world of Wagner's Holy Grail operas. Debussy wrote that he was thinking of that orchestral colour that seems to be lit from behind, of which there are such wonderful examples in Parsifal. Je, games, plural, tennis, and something else. The programme note from the Paris premiere in 1913 hints at the sexual subtext. The scene is a garden at dusk. A tennis ball has been lost. A boy and two girls are searching for it. The artificial light of the large electric lamps shedding fantastic rays about them suggests the idea of childish games. They play hide and seek. They try to catch one another. They quarrel. They sulk without cause. The night is warm. The sky is bathed in pale light. They embrace. But the spell is broken by another tennis ball thrown in mischievously by an unknown hand. Surprised and alarmed, the boy and girls disappear into the nocturnal depths of the garden. And here's Sir Simon Rattle to reveal the flirtatious dances taking place on a tennis court at twilight in Debussy's Je.
Thank you.
jeu, games of seduction on a tennis court overtaken by darkness. A late masterpiece by Debussy. First performed in Paris by the Ballet Russe with choreography by Nijinsky, fresh from his scandalous enactment of Debussy's Prelude à l'après-midi d'un fun. And playing games with Debussy's score for us here in the Royal Albert Hall was the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. And if perhaps Debussy's score didn't quite seem to have had the lasting acclaim it so clearly deserved, then maybe it's because of what happened next. 2 weeks after Je came the premiere of Nijinsky's next ballet, to a score by Igor Stravinsky. It was called The Rite of Spring, and the famously sensational premiere seemed to have wiped Debussy's beautifully crafted ballet from most people's memory. Well, a year earlier, in 1912, Maurice Ravel's longest and most lavish orchestral score was unleashed on the Ballet Russe's Paris public, Daphnis and Chloe. And we're about to hear the second suite Ravel prepared from it, which conducts us from a truly spectacular orchestral sunrise to the ecstatic general dance that ends the ballet by way of the pantomime where the god Pan plays his solo flute. And the suite works so well as a colourful symphonic triptych that you don't actually need to know the story at all to be staggered by Ravel's oral imagination and deliriously, deliciously colourful orchestration. It's one of those scores that seems to deliver new levels of detail, fresh insights and intricacies at every hearing. It's an absolute tour de force for an orchestra. And a pretty big orchestra it is as well. I haven't mentioned the orchestral layout either. The first and second violins are on the conductor's left, violas on the right, cellos next to them, just right of centre. And the double basses are behind in pairs, stacked almost vertically. That's one of the secrets to the huge sound they make. And here's Simon Rattle to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in the suite number 2 from Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. You may need sunglasses. The general dance that ends the second suite that Maurice Ravel abstracted from his ballet score, Daphnis and Chloe, retelling the story of one of the earliest known novels, as it's sometimes called, from ancient Greece. A considerable success for the Ballet Russe in Paris in 1912, and exactly a century later, it seems to have gone down rather well in London. You just heard the Berliner Philharmonica and its principal conductor, Sir Simon Rattle, great favourites whenever they make an appearance here at the BBC Proms. And the second Rattle had finished conducting the last bars of that suite, he stepped down from the podium and immediately shook by the hand the front desks of every string section he could reach. And the leader of the Berlin Philharmonic this evening is Daishin Kashimoto. They have three first concertmasters at the Berlin Philharmonic, all employed on equal terms, and they take turns in leading the orchestra. Simon Rattle back on stage, and he's marched straight through the strings to embrace this evening's principal flautist, Andreas Blau, I think. Rattle standing in front of him, applauding him and passing on his very personal congratulations to the entire woodwind team. Here they are, on their feet, all of them, applauded generously by the other members of the orchestra. Now the eight members of the percussion section, Celesta, two harps, the brass, now the strings on their feet as well. Everybody getting their turn in the spotlight. Actually, before the rehearsals began this morning, there was a series of speeches and poems from the podium. Not Simon Rattle, as one of the horn players, Klaus Wallendorf, who was working his way through a list of anniversaries and one retirement, because at the end of this summer tour, viola player Slav Polonek is leaving after 31 years with the Berlin Philharmonic. His son, Christoph, is one of the orchestra's first violins, so they were actually joking that with a bit of luck, one day he might just be good enough to get into the viola section, reversing the orchestral tradition of the viola joke. And there's a birthday as well today. Martin Kretzer, one of the longest-standing members of the orchestra, who was solo trumpeter under Herbert von Karajan. Simon Rattle shaking the hands of Daishin Kashimoto and at the front. I don't know what they're saying to each other, but they're obviously sharing a joke. There's a lot of laughter going on at the front. The significant 30th anniversaries were mentioned this morning as well. Bass player Peter Riegelbauer, second violinist Holm Birkholz, and Swiss first violinist Madeleine Caruzzo, all of whom joined the Berlin Philharmonic in 1982. Madeleine was the first woman to be admitted to the orchestra. The second was a clarinetist you might have heard of, Sabine Meyer. And right now there are 19 women in the orchestra, 17 string players, flautist Jelka Weber, and one of three Brits, horn player Sarah Willis. And this time, Rattle's just got the orchestra to their feet and he's stood back to let them take all of the applause and the cheers from the promenaders. Well, don't forget that if you missed any of this evening's prom, you can listen again online for the next week. And if you can't be near a radio for tomorrow's Berlin Philharmonic prom, you can listen online in HD sound. It's quite a different programme, just two works. Brahms's second piano concerto in splendid isolation in the first half with soloist Yefim Bronfman and Witold Lutosławski's Symphony No. 3. But that was The Berliners at the Proms, Part 1, a sequence of journeys between darkness and light. I'm not sure which way we're headed right now, but back in Broadcasting House, here's Jonathan Sway.
Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew McGregor with tonight's prom. And just as eagerly anticipated as the Berlin Philharmonic's two proms will be the ones from the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and the Vienna Philharmonic over the next week or so. Ricardo Chailly and the Leipzig Orchestra devote one whole concert on Saturday night to the composer who put the orchestra on the map, Felix Mendelssohn, including the Violin Concerto and the Fifth Symphony, and then two more composer M's in their concert on Sunday night. Messiaen's War Memorial Piece, Et Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum, and Mahler's Sixth Symphony. 7:30 starts for both those evening concerts, both of them live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Well, back to tonight, and at 10:30, post-prom music and poetry from emerging young artists in Proms Plus. And before it, this evening's feature, Judith Kampfner, on the best interpretation in the arts of the 9/11 attacks. That's at 10:15. Until then, back to Debussy, the Debussy Preludes. This one is Ce qu'a vu le vent d'ouest, literally, What the West Wind Saw, a very mysterious title, but the piece itself is full of elemental uproar. The pianist is Stephen Osborne. The Girl with the Flaxen Hair, and before it, Debussy in His Element with the Elements. They're a billowing west wind, Ce qu'a vu le vent d'ouest. Two of the Debussy Book One preludes, played there by Stephen Osborne. It's just gone 9:45, and you're listening to BBC Radio 3. In 1937, Picasso responded to the bombing of the Spanish town of Guernica with his shattering visual comment on the atrocity. And in tonight's feature, Judith Kempfner asks whether there's been any similar artistic legacy from the American artistic community, especially in New York, as a response to the events of 9/11. This programme was first heard last year on the 10th anniversary, but the questions about whether there is any work of artistic merit that evokes the tragedy still remain. Judith begins A Guernica for Gotham with her own memories of that day.
10 years ago, I was working as a cultural producer for WNYC, New York Public Radio, and the brilliantly sunny morning of Tuesday, September the 11th, began like any other, with me cleaning my teeth and listening to our radio station in the bathroom. Then our morning newscaster took the unusual step of putting an employee from the radio engineering tool shop live on air. Could what this man have just witnessed from his office window really be true? In an odd state of denial, because I remember I wore particularly high-heeled shoes that day, I boarded the subway train for Lower Manhattan to find that it broke its journey close to my side of the Brooklyn Bridge. WNYC was on the upper floors of a wedding cake-shaped building just on the Manhattan side of the water. To get to work, I'd have to walk across the bridge and dodge a police cordon that was set up in front of me and fight against the tide of people running in a pack away from Manhattan and into Brooklyn. I just didn't have the nerve. Dumbly, I went up to a sidewalk coffee cart and stood there clutching my cup of coffee, numb and confused. Confusion, I later realised, was a common response of many people that day.
It was chaos. Chaos. It was chaos. Nobody knew. Nobody. Nobody knew what to do. Nobody.
I couldn't get into work for 3 weeks. Our building was evacuated because it was only a few blocks from Ground Zero, and a core staff camped out in a midtown office to run the radio station. I was given some cultural assignments. Go to a mosque, find out if Muslim children are being victimized at school, find out what music people are listening to, and find out if they're more likely to go to art galleries in larger numbers. And that's how I came to be interviewing Glenn Lowry, the head of the Museum of Modern Art, for a short morning feature that aired a couple of weeks after 9/11.
We will look to find ways in which we could open our doors to the community and welcome people and at the same time offer them the kind of safe harbor and sanctuary where they can deal with this terrible, terrible situation.
I asked him whether someone might produce a work of art like Pablo Picasso's Guernica to interpret or pay homage to what had just happened.
I think it's much too soon to tell whether this particular occasion will inspire an artist to create something as iconic and moving and enduring as Guernica. Although I do think if anyone can grapple with the horrors of what's happened, it will be artists.
Now, 10 years down the line, I've been back to the Museum of Modern Art to ask Mr. Lowry to revisit what we discussed.
I think one of the really important things to remember is at the time of September 11th, it was so clear that there was a sense of victimization in New York and elsewhere in the United States that was subject to terrorist attacks, and a kind of almost universal sympathy and feeling for the United States in the wake of this traumatic event. But several years later, other than the tyranny of the decimal system, and thus we recognize it's been a decade since it happened, there are so many other issues that we're dealing with today. You know, debt crises, the aftershocks of war, an economy that has, you know, really soured in this country and in many others, unemployment at 10% or almost 10%. You know, it all kind of settles down into a different configuration is the way I think one has to look at it. And I think that's why there are relatively few works of art that have emerged as being part of a critical dialogue, both about art making and about September 11th.
No one admits they ever cry in public. Lately we all do because we must. We do because a man stands at the bottom of a building looking for his brother's body in the dust. It hit home. It still does. It hits home.
Suzanne Vega put together a compilation album called Vigil, a collection of songs sent to her by friends who'd recorded them spontaneously in their homes in the last months of 2001, with proceeds going to a relief fund. There were many creative endeavours like that, but it's unlikely that artists thought they were making pieces that were enduring works. These were more outpourings of emotion, a need to express shock and communicate the unspoken. After all, a problematic event stirs a creative impulse more than a happy one. Immediacy has impact, but lacks depth. My search for significant work turns out to be more frustrating and difficult than I'd anticipated. A decade ago, when I'd interviewed Glenn Lowry, I assumed that out of this great city of artists, there would be some great works of art that would somehow illustrate what 9/11 meant for future generations. Glenn seemed to be thinking the same thing. At the time, there were tears in your eyes, and you said, if anybody can respond to this, an artist can.
I still feel that way. Now, whether that artist is a writer, or a cinematographer, or a visual artist, or musician for that matter, is a different story. But I think artists are generally the most sensitive, thoughtful people with a kind of fearlessness to tackle impossibly difficult subjects. And I think trauma is about as difficult a subject as there is.
In the sculpture garden at MoMA, there's a 1940s statue by Aristide Maillot called The River, a large, naked woman with her legs in the air and her head reaching backwards, perhaps into the water. In the autumn of 2002, New York artist Eric Fischel showed a work called Tumbling Woman at Rockefeller Center that was inspired by that Maillot. A columnist in the New York Post described it as violently disturbing, as if it was somersaulting backwards with its head crashing onto the pavement. A week later, the sculpture was shrouded and then removed. Today, the statue only exists in private collections. I wanted to see this bronze in the flesh. So Eric Fischel took me to visit a copy of Tumbling Woman, placed under a tree, surrounded by lawns and a massive sprinkler system, in the garden of a villa on Long Island.
This is the side of the head. And that's the thigh.
That's the belly.
And that's a somewhat saggy belly.
I think the journalist who turned this into a sensational sculpture had never actually seen the sculpture. And so she was going on hearsay or a photo impression or something like that. The quality, I think, that the sculpture has is almost dreamlike. It's a kind of a passive tumbling.
She doesn't look as if she's in pain.
No. No, she looks like she is in a kind of a lateral motion, tumbling, which for me was really speaking more to the state of the country after 9/11, not to the specific event of the people who jumped or fell from the towers as they crumbled.
People jumping from the building. Jumping from the building.
Would Tumbling Woman have looked disturbing in a concrete setting in Midtown Manhattan? Here next to a tennis court, she looks motherly despite her muscularity. Fischel had wanted to make a solid, tangible body.
For me, it was very important to remind people that this was a human tragedy, not an architectural one. You know, try to keep us focused on on that. And 3,000 people died within a very short period of time, and there were no bodies. And it's very hard to process death and loss without a tangible body to verify the absence that has just occurred.
The AP photo that was published and then quickly taken away had a similar response. I mean,
yeah, it was censored immediately.
Many papers which printed The Falling Man by Richard Drew, of a man falling headfirst from the North Tower, never showed that photograph again. It continues to be controversial, but it's easy to find on the internet. Eric Fischel said he never anticipated that his statue would receive such public criticism as to be forcibly removed from Rockefeller Center.
I was, you know, begging with Jerry Speier to not remove it. He's the owner of the Rockefeller Center and stuff, and he was claiming that he was getting bomb threats. He didn't want to endanger the 5,000 people that worked at Rockefeller Center. I was saying I doubt people were actually going to bomb him. The thing is, I was powerless to insist that he do it. It was his property, it wasn't mine. So.
Do you hope that it will come back to the Ground Zero area at some point?
I don't believe that it will ultimately find its way there, but I do wish it that would, yeah.
You know, that may turn out to be an important work.
MoMA's Glenn Lowry.
The less literal works are, the more likely they are to acquire that ongoing resonance. But Eric is a brilliant artist, seriously thoughtful man, and you know, anyone who was physically around can't help but have been impacted by that.
When Picasso unveiled his mural Guernica, astonishingly only 15 days after the town Guernica was bombed in 1937, it was met with overwhelming criticism. People said it was a jumble of tortured images, contradictory meanings, and not realist enough to be political. It was made in France, but it ended up in New York, here at the Museum of Modern Art. After Franco died, it was given back to Spain in 1981, according to the artist's wishes. Just 13 days after 9/11, Art Spiegelman's cover of the New Yorker magazine was almost the opposite of the wonderfully crowded Guernica. But if you held it in your hands that day, you'll never forget it. Silhouettes of black towers on a plain black background.
The Spiegelman New Yorker cover, I mean, it's now goes into that category of legendary, right? I mean, and the New Yorker has always been prescient in its ability to find artists who can transform quotidian events into something that we all remember. I haven't thought about that in a while.
I mean, isn't it partly brilliant? It's hard for people who just see a picture of it to understand. There was something kind of tactile about that cover. There was almost a 3D-ishness about it.
He managed in a way, and humor is not the right word, but in a way that with a light touch, he managed to get down in what I think many New Yorkers felt. The difference when one invokes a work like Guernica with what is happening broadly today is that it's the difference between, you know, one of those rare moments that a work can symbolize an entire time and generation. That doesn't happen all the time.
America is essentially an ahistorical culture. So there's not a lot of amazing works of art in American culture that deal specifically with historical events. But I still don't understand why artists didn't step forward in greater number to tackle the monumental scale of it.
Is it because it takes courage to tackle something difficult and disturbing?
I think it's because art hasn't felt like it was responsible to the greater public. I think each art form requires a certain amount of time, and that their time is different. You know, that it might take longer. The photography was there immediately. Photography and video were there at the moment of occurrence.
Susan Mysalis, as a photographer, took some of the most potent images of the immediate aftermath of September 11th. And in fact, to my mind, when I think about that that day, it's Susan's images. And she happened to, she's fearless, she happened to be running towards the destroyed Twin Towers just as a mass of people were running away from them. And she just caught the energy, the trauma, the horror of that event in a brilliant way. And it may well be that photography is the medium that best captures this.
But the commodification of photos for sale at souvenir stands that sprung up around the perimeter of Ground Zero was an absolute deluge of tacky images of the towers before and after. Tasteless imagery was everywhere. Gallery curators weren't demonstrating any kind of editorial control. I remember a plane disguised as a sort of zombie bird of prey that seemed particularly crass. Art historian Arthur Danto, who also used to teach philosophy at Columbia University, believes that the true artistic responses come from a feeling of grief and piety.
Here in New York, we had almost immediately these shrines. I wrote about them a little bit, but they were everywhere. Just suddenly, all at once, every step, every windowsill, every fire station, there was some improvised shrines. But one of the artists, she did a shrine, so to speak, emulating the shrines that the people who were putting out vernacular shrines, but made of it a work of art, because each thing is selected with a meaning and a different signification. It was a work of art, no question.
That artist was Leslie King Hammond. Her installation, Prayer for the New Ancestors, was an arrangement of necklaces, LPs, a flag, newspaper cuttings, all on different altars, dignifying the anonymous. In a similar way, the New York Times printed memorials, and novelist Meg Wolitzer found a story in each of them.
They were short. It was like all you could tolerate, these short things. They came with a photograph. They gave a little bit of life to each person. It was like each one was kind of briefly inflated for a moment, you know, back to some kind of life. You would hear about the young father who was a Grateful Dead head and how much he loved his son Zachary. You know, you would hear these stories. And I think that was more novelistic than anything I've read.
On the Transmigration of Souls by John Adams uses texts from these New York Times portraits. The young man says he was tall, extremely good-looking, and girls never talked to me when he was around.
Life did return to a kind of normal. It's an anxious normal, and it has inconveniences, and it has a deep dread at its heart. Those are the things that the novelist can get at again and again and again in a lot of ways. I don't know if a or the definitive 9/11 novel will ever be written, but I would absolutely read a big and powerful 9/11 novel. I probably would read it more than I would write it.
And have you any idea who it might come from?
No, I really don't. It might come from a surprising non-establishment figure who was maybe young at the time, you know? I think that maybe shards of it have been written in all of these different ways. Some of it online, some of it in pieces in magazines, newspaper journalism, and these portraits, and in some of these novels. but I don't know that it requires that a great work come out of it. I don't know. I mean, is it because it's cathartic? Is that why we want that?
Do you think there are lots of stories, ordinary people's stories, that are waiting to be collected? I mean, my son, who used to stutter as a little kid, stuttered, came back that day. Really? Yeah. All over there must be, you know, and it's all buried still.
But you see, that's a novel. The boy who stuttered came back. You're moving away from the event, but you're moving into something interesting because it's talking about how humans are changed by this. That's really how someone is changed by it. And I don't even know what it means. Like, why would the stutter come back? As a novelist, I'm thinking, that's a great thing for a novel.
There are literary works, and here I'm thinking of DeLillo's The Falling Man and Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Andrew Schopp teaches a course in 9/11 literature at Nassau Community College outside New York City.
That evoke the sense of loss, and I think Jonathan Safran Foer's novel, especially because it's narrated by a 9-year-old boy who, among other things, is carrying around a tremendous amount of guilt because of, I don't want to give it away, but what happened on the day with respect to his father who died in the attacks, is incredibly moving. And that sense of loss that he and that his mother and that the people around him experience is very palpable. It's a very beautiful novel in that sense.
Something like the Don DeLillo book or the Jonathan Safran Foer book, I think we're trying to take this sort of unmanageable event and unmanageable feelings and do what they knew to do as novelists, which is to give them characters. And through doing that, these walking, talking creatures inhabit this dazed landscape and give it some meaning.
The Falling Man begins with Keith, the protagonist, leaving, you know, escaping the tower, and it ends sort of back with him in, you know, his experience in the towers. A kind of falling man in the sense that he's still sort of trying to land, as it were, in his life, try to find a place to be in his life. The Falling Man then becomes a perhaps even a symbol of how are we as a culture going to continue.
So you could say this is a completely non-exploitative use of the image.
I would say, I don't think it's well, I say that and then I keep thinking, but you titled the book The Falling Man. So of course, at some level there's...
It helps book sales.
Of course. I mean, of course.
If you want to write a novel that takes place in New York City, it's become this elephant. Do you deal with 9/11? How do you deal with it? And you have to sort of deal with it one way or another. You can't not. I resent that deeply. It almost seems like when I start a novel that takes place in New York City, I start to think, oh, wait a minute. Are these characters hurling thoughtlessly toward that day? Are you doing it to sensationalize and titillate and frighten everybody? You know, because when I, you know, having lived here during 9/11 and in the days after, really more to the point, I think the days after, the shock that people felt and the kind of trying to understand when you had no precedent for it in your life, you know, that's interesting to me. Rather than, you know, the glass in his windows rattled, you know, Joseph looked up.
Anyway, did you know they started construction on the towers the year I was born? 1968. And it took them more than 5 years to finish it. I remember coming up to visit my aunt out in Brooklyn for Easter, and you could see it from her kitchen window on State Street. And each year, it was a little bit taller, a little bit more finished. And I kept asking her, can we go up to the top yet? It was like this obsession I had as a kid. And I just couldn't wait until it was done. The top of the world, I kept calling it. It was an amazing view. I never took it for granted. Every time someone would come to visit me, I'd take them up there, and every time, it was a wonder. Standing on top, with only the sound of the wind, you couldn't hear any of the street noise of the city that high up. Just wind. And if it was clear enough, you could see the curvature of the earth. That was something. Why does this thing? I mean, it was just a building, right?
an excerpt from WTC View by Brian Sloan. Like the character in his play, Brian was obsessed by the Twin Towers, and when he came to live in New York, he made sure he got a view of the World Trade Center. 2 days before 9/11, he advertised for a new roommate under the heading WTC View. In the week that followed, a whole host of dislocated people turned up, even to this ravaged neighborhood.
You know, it was sort of a life in wartime situation. The character talks about F-15s flying over his apartment, and this happened on a fairly regular basis. There was lots of military, police, you know.
There were tanks in the streets.
Yeah, there were literally tanks in the streets. And, you know, in those months afterwards, I would run into friends and I'd be like, oh, where's your boyfriend or husband or partner? And, oh, we broke up last week. And I'd be like, I was always just shocked. I'm like, really? Or I would run into somebody and they'd be all over this other person. Like, who's that? He's like, oh, this is my new boyfriend. We just moved in last week, you know? Or this is my new fiance. We're getting married in a month. And that sort of, everything was just so accelerated at that time. People were just literally reevaluating their lives because they knew suddenly their lives were really quite precious and could be over in an instant.
They came from Boston on an airline and they headed south.
Someone who had a home closer to the Twin Towers and who couldn't get back was the composer Steve Reich. In 2011, his 15-minute composition, WTC 9/11, was premiered in New York and London. The piece includes archive tape, as well as recent reflective interviews the composer recorded with his neighbours.
I said, I want to do the sync sound of that. So you go, he came from Boston, and the end just goes on as long as you like, and a viola can double that, and then the next person speaks, and the LS, and pretty soon you're forming chords out of what people have said, and tying together people harmonically. Because the first idea I had in this piece was to sustain the last syllable of every speaker, not even knowing who the speakers were. I had an abstract musical idea that preceded this entire undertaking. That had nothing to do with 9/11. One of the traffic controllers says, no contact with the pilot whatsoever, and the R is sustained like a growl. And it was musical thought that I had since the 1970s. I wanted to do the sync action of stop action in film. You know, when you go to a movie and the frame just stops. On 9/11 itself, I was in Vermont. My son and my granddaughter and my daughter-in-law, Beryl, and I were in Vermont. They were in New York. And my son called about 8:30 in the morning and says, I think they bombed the World Trade Center again, because they bombed it in 1993. And we said, don't hang up. And then turn on television, and just in time to see the second plane hit. So I said, we had double windows in New York. I said, make sure both the double windows are closed. Go into the bathroom. I have these hardware store masks. Put them on the baby and yourself and your wife and keep them on. They're not much, but they're something. And don't leave. Don't go outside until you get our neighbors come back. And eventually our neighbor got them out of the city 6 hours later, kind of miraculously. Okay, a couple of months, they came out of the city. We picked them up. They went to Vermont. We had to stay up there for about a month because the National Guard and the Army were down there, and you couldn't go to where we live. We couldn't go back to our home. 30 days later, if you showed ID that proved that you lived there,